funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. Human beings have been making and consuming alcohol for 10,000 years. But as the millennia have passed, we understand surprisingly little about the chemistry and biology behind how we make alcohol and how those drinks affect our minds and bodies. My guest today has been thinking about the art and science of drinking since he was old enough to visit a bar. And it's led him to distilleries, wineries, and breweries at home and abroad, pondering the role that alcohol plays in our lives. Adam Rogers is the articles editor at Wired Magazine. His new book is called Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
So you attach a lot of significance to our relationship to alcohol. In fact, fairly early in the book, you describe a pretty ordinary trip to a bar as representing the single most important event in human history.
It's possible I'm being maybe intentionally hyperbolic there, but it's on purpose. I mean, I do think that alcohol and our relationship with alcohol represents a kind of a hologram. It's a lens through which you can understand the human relationship to our environment, to nature, to science, and to technology. That alcohol turns up kind of Forrest Gump-like at all kinds of critical moments in our evolution from Homo sapiens to people, becoming civilized and becoming technologists.
Scientists and anthropologists estimate that humans have been consuming alcohol for about 10,000 years. How do we come up with that number?
Well, I would say, too, it may be longer than that. It's just that it's about 10,000 years is the oldest evidence of human-controlled fermentation, right? And where that comes from is the work of a researcher named Patrick McGovern. He's at Penn, and he has in his office this little shard. It's about the size of a deck of cards from a pot found at an archaeological site in China called Jiahu. And it's a really interesting site. Jiahu is the place where some of the oldest musical instruments were found, some of the earliest examples of writing, of written language, some of the oldest examples of human beings eating rice. So it's a really, it's important in the history of civilization, you know. And in this pot, when they found this shard, there was this weird residue inside it. So McGovern has a lot of analytical chemistry tools at his disposal, and he shot all of them at this stuff, this gunk that was on the bottom of the pot. Gas chromatography, mass spectroscopy, Feigl spot tests, ultraviolet lasers, you know, the whole lab kind of beaming things at this little piece of clay. And what he found was not ethanol, because you don't find ethanol archaeologically or in history. It's volatile. It's evanescent. It disappears. And that's actually important later for what we do with alcohol chemically. But what he did find was three things. He found beeswax, which you only get if there was honey present. He found evidence of rice, and he found evidence of tartaric acid, tartrates, which are usually, if you found those, you would say, well, that's evidence that there were grapes, but probably not from then and there, probably not from China in that period. He thinks that it was hawthorn, which is a fruit he describes as being a little bit like a chalky apple almost. If you combine those things, if you mix those things up and let them sit, you'd have a hard time not having them ferment. You know, like it's just, it'd be difficult to keep wild yeast out of them and converting the sugars that are in that mix into ethanol and carbon dioxide and alcohol that we drink. So it's sort of the mother eve of booze, right? I mean, it's this stuff that has honey, which we make into mead, it has rice, which we make into sake, and it had fruit, which we make into wines and brandies. And this is the oldest piece of evidence so far of people making something that they would then ferment and then consume.
And there's an idea that this interest by early humans in making alcohol might have actually driven them to settle down a little bit.
Yeah, that's the archaeologists and anthropologists call that the bread versus beer hypothesis. And the idea is that, you know, why did we settle down? Why did we start planting grain crops in rows? Was it because we wanted to make that grain into bread, or was it because we wanted to make that grain into beer? You can imagine I fall on the beer side of that question.
Okay, let's talk about the science behind how ethanol is produced. Can you explain how fermentation works?
Oh, man. well, if I
in its
could,
simplest
have,
form, let's say
I'd have more letters behind my name. That's actually one of those scientific questions that's very simple and also very complicated. So, at the very basic level, you have yeast, right? And yeast, in the way that yeast make energy, the way that they metabolize food from their environment, is that they take in sugars like glucose, sucrose, right? And in the
are you there, Adam?
Energy molecule called ATP, they process that sugar into ethanol and carbon dioxide. So ethanol is the alcohol that we drink, right? Carbon dioxide is that gas that we exhale. I am, yeah. Did they lose me?
No, I think you're back. No, we got you. Go ahead. Do we have Adam?
Hello?
Let's see. I think we're having a little difficulty connecting with Adam. We're talking to him about his book.
Yeah,
which is called.
Oh, you got it.
Okay. So you were talking
about that.
Yeah, no problem. So you were talking about how yeasts essentially turn sugar sources into ethanol.
That's right. It's the way that yeast eat, you know,
okay.
And it's what we do too. It's we consume nutrients from our environment, and we don't use everything in those molecules, and we excrete some of it. What yeast do when they excrete is they're excreting ethanol and they're excreting carbon dioxide. So the alcohol that we drink and that same gas that we exhale, that's the basics of it. Now, the actual process is much more complicated, right?
Sure.
They're also excreting a bunch of other kind of molecules. Some of those contribute to flavors and the things that we drink. They like certain kinds of sugars, but not others. They like doing that at a certain kind of temperature. What we've done as human beings is domesticated this process. This is a process that's been going on in nature for 150 million years. But it's in the last, you know, let's say 10,000, that we tamed it. I would say we domesticated the yeast to make the kind of things we like to drink. And in a way, they domesticated us, right? They learned to roll over and show us their tummies and wag their tails in return for what they wanted to eat, for a little bit of scrap of sugar that we had to offer them.
And it wasn't until, let's say, the late 1800s that scientists actually understood that yeast were the ones that were converting sugar into ethanol. And you argue that that was really the beginning of the field of biochemistry.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing, is that human beings were doing this for at least 10,000 years without knowing how it worked, right? They didn't know what the thing was. They knew that they had to keep some of this stuff, whatever it was, and mix it in with the sugar solution, wherever they got that from, whether that was grape juice or kind of a oatmeal or polenta or something, you know, wherever they were getting the sugar, whatever the substrate was, they had to mix something back into it, but they didn't know what. And it was actually a huge argument, and a lot of the leading lights in science in the 1700s and 1800s tried to figure it out and kind of failed. You know, Van Leeuwenhoek, the guy who invented the microscope, put beer under that microscope, and he actually saw a yeast, but he didn't know what they were. He drew pictures of them, and he sent them to the Royal Society and said, I don't know, let's try to figure that out. Lavoisier, the guy who discovered oxygen and hydrogen, was the first person to say, you know, it's the sugar that's getting turned into the ethanol. But he didn't know why. He didn't know what it was doing. It wasn't until 1837 that somebody actually proposed the idea that you had to have the yeast. And he was roundly ridiculed, because if you think about it, it's kind of ridiculous, right? You have little invisible guys that eat the sugar and then basically, should pardon the expression, poop out the alcohol. Like, it is preposterous on its face.
Sure.
It wasn't until, actually, another researcher got involved in the 1850s, a young guy named Louis Pasteur, who got called in to try to understand what was going wrong in a fermentation of sugar beet in Lille in France. And he's the one who, this is, you know, Pasteur before he's big. This is like when only hipsters know about Pasteur. He's not famous yet. He hasn't done rabies yet. He hasn't done pasteurization yet. But he's a brilliant experimenter. And he goes into this fermentation facility, at least this is what the story says, and he says, well, you know, if I look at the fermentation that's working under a microscope, all I see are yeast. But if I look at the fermentation that's not working, that smells like spoiled milk, I see the yeast and I see these other little black things, and I don't know what they are. But clearly that's something else that's making this go wrong. And it turned out that what they were lactic acid bacteria, were the bacteria that we rely on for pickling and the things that are responsible for milk spoilage, right? So he didn't know how to fix the problem. And he went, again, this is a potentially apocryphal story about Pasteur's life, but he went back to the producer and he said, look, you got to clean out and sterilize that tank. I don't know how to kill that stuff, but you got to start over. Mm. And meanwhile, he took some of the gunk from the fermentation that was working, and he mixed it in a flask with some sugar solution. And he took some of the gunk from the fermentation that wasn't working, and he did that in a separate flask and got ethanol in one and not ethanol in the other. It's the kind of brilliant experimental design that Pasteur would end up proving that he was so good at. And this finally was proof, although the argument went on for decades after that, because the chemists, right, didn't believe it. The chemists thought, how could you possibly need a living thing to do a transformation? What they were really trying to figure out here was how things change, right? And that was unclear to scientists then. And they thought fermentation encompassed things like changing sugar into ethanol, but also lactic acid in pickling, acetic acid for making vinegar. And even some people even thought decomposition was a kind of fermentation, right? Because it's something that was one thing changing chemically to something else. And nobody knew how that would be possible. How could a living thing be responsible for it? Well, trying to figure that out is what gave rise to an understanding of enzymes, right, which are the proteins that living things make that make those transformations possible, that enable chemical transformations. And understanding that there was chemistry that happened inside a living thing, inside yeast and inside us, was the beginning of a union of these two groups. You know, biologists and chemists are always a little bit like the sharks and the jets. They always think that they're the ones who have a deeper understanding of the universe. And, geez, if you bring physicists into it, it's even worse fight. But in this case, the biologists and the chemists had to find a detente. You know, they had to find a middle ground. What they ended up inventing to study this field was biochemistry.
So, of course, for yeast to do their part in fermentation, you need to provide them with some source of sugar. And we sort of take it for granted that wine has always been made out of grapes, but there's actually a pretty good reason for that.
Yeah, grapes are great, right? I mean, what you want is you want to provide simple sugar to yeast. And so where do you get that? You can get it from honey, right? I mean, you can make mead by just mixing honey with water and letting it sit. You can get it from apples. You know, in some respects, the colonies that became the United States were built on a foundation of fermented apple cider. But grapes are really good. They're 25% sugar, for one thing. Yeast really like to grow on the skins, so the yeast live there. They grow in a lot of places because they grow on vines, on lianes, right? You can stretch them on other things. You can grow them draped on other plants that you already have or draped on your fence. And you can manipulate them. You know, every wine that we drink is all just one species of grape. It's all Vitis vinifera. But it's been split off into a bunch of strains that agronomists, that agriculturalists, people who work with grapes, have bred up because grapes are really, I wouldn't say easy to turn into new strains, but grapes really like to do that. Now, it's possible that's just coincidence, right?
Right.
It is certainly possible that the reason that human beings started using grapes is that they were the easy sugar source available in the Caucasian mountain region of the Fertile Crescent about when people started to settle down. There's one researcher who I talked to who said that, you know, if civilization had first started on like a Pacific island, we'd have hundreds of different strains of coconut to make different kinds of booze out of, and the grape would be an obscure thing over in the corner of the produce section of the grocery store.
And as the Western world has been busy using grapes, the Eastern world fermented rice. And I think it's interesting how these very different cultures independently found their ways to alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't want to say that every human culture finds its way to making alcohol, but certainly many of us do at one point or another. It is a natural process that we find out in the world and then we start to manipulate. And that's, you know, my argument is that's how we become scientists, right? You find this process and you try to understand how it works, and you also want to try to you want to understand how it works because you want to control it, basically. You want to make it, you want to improve it, you want it to do a thing that you can consume and maybe even sell. Like maybe there's a way to add value to some product. And rice is different, right? As soon as you start talking about grains, you're dealing with a whole other set of complicated issues in the making of all this stuff because, like I said, yeast wants simple sugar, right? But in grains, the sugars are stored as multiple units. They're built to get built up into big structures like Legos. So instead of sugars, you have starch. Now, human beings can digest starch. We have enzymes, even in our saliva, that'll break starch into simpler sugars for us to consume to use for fuel. But yeast can't. So we have to figure out ways to convert those starches into sugar for them. And the way we do that in the West and the way they do that in the East, the way that Asian countries using rice do it, is very different than what we do, right? So what we do is a process called malting. You might have heard of single malt whiskey, right?
Sure.
That's what that is. What we do is we let the barley, and it's usually barley because that's one of the easiest ones to do it with, kind of germinate. So we let it start to grow. We trick the seeds into thinking that they're someplace where they're going to grow. And that starts a whole chain of biochemical processes that begin to make enzymes in the seed itself that convert the starch that's stored there as fuel. The starch in the seed is a little bit like the yolk in a chicken egg. It's fuel for the embryo. Right.
Adam, I got to jump in, take a quick break. We're talking to Adam Rogers about his new book, Proof, the Science of Booze. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Adam Rogers, and we're talking about his new book, Proof, the Science of Booze. So I thought we'd move on to distillation, which takes fermentation and kicks it up a notch. Can you explain how distillation works?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I should pause too. I am very conscious of the fact that I am now the world's most annoying person to have a drink with.
Why is that?
You know, this is my kind of, I guess, my kind of connoisseurship in a way, that I feel like this is a way to appreciate this drink that, you know, somebody puts a drink in front of you and you have a drink if you're the sort of person who does that, and it's a really pleasant experience, right? And this is a way to sort of dive very deeply into that shallow glass. So, you know, I don't want to, I know that I can start to give a chemistry lecture sometimes, mm-hmm. and I sort of don't mean to do that. I mean, so you asked about distillation. So distillation is super cool, right? And distillation dates back to alchemists in ancient Alexandria trying to figure out lab techniques, ways to understand the world. One of the things that a story that I like, which may or may not be true about where distillation was actually invented, is that it was invented by a woman who was one of the first alchemists named Maria the Jewess. I know, but I didn't name her. Also invented something called the Bain Marie, a double boiler that you would use in a laboratory. So she was the kind of person who came up with the gear that you use to try to understand the universe. And the still was one of those things. It's basically a separation technology, right? In the same way that we use, let's say, filters to separate things by their size, right? Or we use a centrifuge to spin things around really fast, and you separate things by their weight. And there are other techniques. You can separate things by electric charge. You can separate. This is a way to break apart a mixture, right? And so distillation does that based on vapor pressure, based on what temperature something evaporates at, right? So you put a little bit of heat in the bottom, and the things that evaporate first, the lighter molecules, things like ethanol, for example, go up to the top, and they go over the top of a still, and then they recondense into a liquid. So with distillation, you're able to, using sort of time and space, take something that you've fermented, like let's say a wine, and change it into something more concentrated and pick out the molecules that you want, basically. And if you do that enough, if you keep going on and on and on, you can eliminate everything except ethanol and water. That's vodka, right? Just ethanol and water. But depending on where you stop and depending on what your substrate is, depending on what you started with, you can get anything from a rum, right, that you made from fermented molasses, or tequila that you made from fermented agave pulp. All those things run through basically the same process of distillation. And this is where, you know, this is where the metaphors start to overlap with the technology, with the scientific achievement. This is why William Faulkner, noted drinker William Faulkner, said civilization begins with distillation, right? He meant it, I like to think, both metaphorically and literally. He meant that when we boil things down, when we get to the essence of something, right, which is what distillation does literally, that we're becoming more civilized, we're being better human beings. But I think in the literal sense, it's true that when we figured out how to distill, that was the beginning of our lives on this planet as engineers, as technologists. You know, I'm drawing a direct line between that and the supercomputers that we all keep in our pockets.
Now, the stills that are used for distillation, they have this very specific shape, most of them, and they're mostly made out of copper. There must be good reasons for that.
Yeah, totally. There's actually two different kinds of stills that most of the big producers use. And if you're thinking about a place like, I don't know, like Jim Beam or Wild Turkey, right? Most of the distilling they're doing is in a big, tall column, big, wide, six-story thing where they drop the fermented stuff in from the top and the steam up from the bottom. It's a technology that goes back to about the 1860s that lets them run that still 24/7, essentially. But if you're talking about smaller craft distilling in many cases, or single malt whiskey from Scotland, let's say, they use a big pot with kind of a gooseneck coming off the top. It's usually made of copper. And in Scotland, it's always made of copper. And the shape is very important because the shape determines which molecules are going to make it over the top first, or which ones are going to rise up and then kind of condense on the sides of the still and drip back down into the stuff, right? So a taller, more elegant, swan-like still will give you a lighter, fruitier spirit, let's say. But they're all made of copper. And they're made of copper because copper is a really amazing metal, right? So people know that copper conducts electricity really well. That's why we make a lot of wires out of it. Well, copper, for other reasons in physics, also conducts heat very well. And it's really workable, right? It's easy to make shapes out of copper. That's also true of gold and silver. All those properties are true of gold and silver, too. But of those three metals, gold, silver, and copper is the cheapest, right? Mm-hmm. So you get a balance of, like, what metal do I have access to that will do the things that I want? But the really cool thing about copper, and it's something that people didn't really understand until the last century or so, is that copper really likes to bind with sulfur, right? And sulfur, as a flavor, shows up in distillates because one of the things that you're doing when you're distilling something fermented is you get the yeast bodies in there too, the bodies of all of these microbes that you've used to make the fermentation, make it into the still, and then they break open. So you get yeast guts, and yeast guts have sulfur in them. Mm. It's a flavor that people don't like. It's kind of anywhere from like cooked vegetables to like, you know, rotten eggs, right? So you want to get that out. Well, those sulfur atoms really like to stick to copper. It forms kind of a patina on the inside of the still, almost like rust, except rust is oxygen on metal, right? So this is this sulfur gunk. The copper pulls the sulfur out, and you get the better flavors.
You visited Glenlivet in Scotland, which is one of the most famous producers of single malt Scotch whiskies. What did you learn while you were over there?
Well, I will say that visiting distilleries and visiting laboratories are two of my favorite things to do in life. So it's a pleasure to get to visit these distilleries that make stuff that I quite like. Glenlivet's interesting because it's making a single malt whiskey, but it's a huge distillery that's part of an even bigger transnational group of companies. So, you know, they're a giant machine for making whiskey, right? But the thing that interested me the most about Glenlivet is that they're, like a lot of other places, they do this traditional process that I just described, of multiple stills, distilling several times, having the very specific shape that they think is the most important part. But also, this distillery is highly instrumented. It's very technological. There are sensors attached to every still and every tank. They can control every turn of a valve, every move from liquid from one tank to another, at a computer console that's at a desk up at the front that looks like the security desk in a fancy office building. It means that fewer people can do the work. They don't need as many people, but it also means it's much more precise. So it's this, you get this sense of being in a place that's very traditional and done the way they've done it for hundreds of years in Scotland, but also super modern and super technological because they have to get it right every time because they're selling a lot of this around the world. And if it tastes different one time, people aren't going to buy it anymore.
So let's talk a little bit about aging. Why are we willing to wait for these liquors and wines to sit around for a while?
What do you mean, we? I don't know if we're all, I don't know how willing I am about that. I don't know.
Some people who have their 18-year-old scotch or their, you know, bottle of wine from a musty cellar.
Yeah, I mean, we wait because thyme and wood, almost always oak, contribute flavors that so far nobody knows how to get any other way except thyme and contact with the inner surface of a worked barrel. And people understand some of the reasons for that. I mean, we understand some of the lignins and cellulose that comes off of the wood, that's what comprises wood, gets transformed in contact with ethanol, becomes other sugars and flavors. Molecules like vanillin, a vanilla flavor, come out of the wood and get into the distillate, the spirit that you're aging. There's a set of molecules called oak lactones or whiskey lactones that contribute that kind of like coconutty or fatty sort of consistency and flavor and texture that you get in an aged whiskey or an aged wine. And some of it is just time, is straight ahead. If you wait long enough, you get some oxidation, you get the formation of molecules called esters. And all of those things are if I said to you, what do you think the difference is between a young whiskey and an old whiskey or a young wine and an old wine, and you would describe a set of flavors to me, these would be the molecules that would be giving you those aromas and those tastes.
So this probably sounds counterintuitive, but is there any way to speed up the aging process?
Yeah, man, it would be great to accelerate time, wouldn't it? I mean, I would like to not accelerate time for myself because I feel like maybe it's starting to go fast without me. But if you were trying to, let's say, hypothetically, that you're a small distiller, so you don't really have the capital and the time to wait 10 years before you can start selling what you want to make, right? Because you owe money on the land, you know, you got to pay the rent in the warehouse where you're working, whatever. So there are a few things that craft distillers will do to try to get age on their spirit, if that's what they want to make. You can age something in a smaller barrel, so you get more contact of the spirit of the distillate with the wood, right, because the ratio of surface to volume is different. And that works to an extent. You get the extraction from the wood. You don't get those oxidations, esterifications that I was talking about. You can also, some people think you can do things like different kinds of filters. You can play ultrasound or play music at the barrel so that you get more vibration and the wood, the liquid sloshes around, it gets more in contact. There's a company that sends its barrels out onto ships, sends them around the world so that the waves, the motion of the waves, sloshes the liquid around inside the barrels. What there is not is good science yet about how to do this and what works and what doesn't. There are places working on it and trying to figure out the optimal conditions to keep a barrel in so that you get the flavors that you want in less time, because then you fundamentally you have more to sell.
Yeah, I laughed when I read about the company that used to play some Tribe Called Quest songs to use the bass to slosh their liquor around.
Yeah, that's right. This is Tuttletown Spirits. They play music at their spirit. I don't think they do music anymore. An acoustician came in and changed and optimized the frequencies or something. But what they haven't done is run the spirit that had the music played at it and spirit that didn't through a gas chromatograph to try to figure out what the differences were. And that's the kind of science that few places are doing, to try to understand what's behind some of these practices in craft.
Can you explain what the angel's share is?
It's such a beautiful term, isn't it?
It's a beautiful term for something that's kind of sad, I guess.
Bittersweet, maybe.
Yeah.
Use a flavor metaphor. The angel's share is when you were aging a distillate, it evaporates. Some of it gets out of the wood. The barrel is porous. It makes it through in between the waterproof cracks in between each stave of the barrel or through the pores in the wood itself. And depending on the conditions outside, how humid it is, what the temperatures are, that can either be more ethanol or more water that comes out. But whatever happens, you lose volume over time. It's why an aged spirit gets more and more expensive the older it is, because there's actually less of it in the barrel than you put in there in the first place. And that loss, that vanishing spirit is called the angel's share, because people started to think of it as, well, that's what the angel, that's the part of the whiskey, or that's the part of the brandy that the angels get.
And people can actually tell a difference between that more concentrated spirit that's left, though.
Oh, you certainly can. I've gotten a taste of some really old stuff now and then, and I took a sip of a barrel of whiskey that had been lost it was being stored underground in London, and so during World War II, and in the Blitz, the building fell down on top of it. And then it got recovered and then bottled. So by the time I tasted it, it was 50-year-old whiskey, you know, and it had been in the barrel for most of that time. And it was like treacle. I mean, it was super thick, super reduced. A really interesting flavor. I can still kind of taste it. It was really striking.
Like whiskey you can pour on your waffles, huh?
That's a good idea, actually. You may have a restaurant notion there. You should NDA us.
So let's talk some more about taste. One of the things I was actually relieved to read about in your book is that some scientists are actually skeptical that we can take a sip of wine, let's say, and announce proudly to the room that we're picking up elements of shoe leather and fresh-cut grass and Cheetos or whatever it is that you think that you are picking up in the wine, that some people maybe are kind of faking that a little bit. What do you think?
Well, yeah, you take a sip of something really complicated, a great glass of wine, really interesting glass of rum, you know, something that has a lot of complicated flavors and smells in it, and clearly there's a lot going on in there, right? So I don't mean to say that. I don't mean that these things are simple, but I think it is the case and has been shown by researchers that it's very difficult for people to disarticulate more than about four of those aromas at one time.
Mm-hmm.
What you can do is get trained to start to recognize some of those things. And you can get a sense memory for, oh, I've tasted this before, and I kind of know what the model is supposed to be for the thing I'm drinking, if you're like a sommelier, let's say. But being able to taste things, especially things that you have not actually tasted,
right,
like shoe leather, you're sort of describing a smell. What you're really probably describing is kind of new leather and shoe polish smell, maybe, which is a set of chemicals that you could identify and maybe are even present in the wine itself. The issue there, too, is that people don't really understand how the sense of smell and taste work that well. I mean, there's a lot of science on this, and you know, people have won Nobel Prizes for describing a lot of it. But really, it seems to be, especially with aroma, which is primarily where the complicated sense of how things taste comes from for us, the flavors of things, that's some kind of a combinatorial effect. We have all these receptors literally dangling down from our brain, down behind our eyes, and in right above our palate, where our nose and mouth kind of meet. And those are, you know, pieces of our brain that touch little pieces of the thing that we're smelling. It's a very direct sense, right? And some combination of the molecules that come into our nose, come into that layer of neurons, really, and how they touch and when they touch and what order they touch in, that's giving us those complicated smells. And then you have the added problem of how we talk to each other about it. We have this object metaphor problem, whether when I say something smells grassy, you have a sense of what that smell is, but my grassy might not be your grassy, right?
Right. Yeah, and it's that's the trick, is coming up, I guess, with a common language for when you say grassy or you say apples or whatever, we have the same sensation.
And that's what the best scientists who do this research will train a tasting panel first to make sure that everybody on that panel agrees that when I say apple and you say apple, we're talking about the same thing. That's, you have to start the science with that. But, you know, smell and taste are so interesting for this reason. When you're thinking about something like color, let's say, if I say something is red and you agree that it's red, it almost doesn't matter whether we agree, because there's some number of nanometers on the electromagnetic spectrum, on the visible spectrum, that we could both agree objectively is red. Like, that thing is red, and no matter how you see it or how I see it, it's red. But that doesn't exist for smell and taste. You know, there's no spectrum. People have been working on it for centuries trying to figure one out. It's just not there.
Does the kind of glass that we drink something out of really affect the way we taste what we're drinking?
Well, not in the way that people who sell different kinds of glasses will tell you. You know, what the marketing line on that is, this is the glass that you have to use for whiskey. This is the glass that you must use for Pinot Noir, which is different than the one that you would use for Chardonnay, right? Because the headspace captures the particular volatiles that come off of the, that are bubbling up on top of the liquid, and you want those to get to particular parts of your mouth because your tongue senses different tastes in different places. All of those things are not true. None of the things I just said to you are true. What is true is that, you know, a round glass that captures some of those different volatile chemicals that come off the top of a drink will give you a different experience of that drink than if you have it in a straight-sided glass, let's say. That's for sure. And I would also say that because so much of how we smell and taste is about our own, where we are in our heads, it's about our experience and how we're experiencing a moment, it's all tied in with our emotions and our feelings at any given moment and how we remember things from our childhood and what our favorite flavors and least favorite flavors are, so that the theater of what you were drinking has a huge impact on how you perceive it. And it should. That's fine. Like, that's kind of great. The story that I tell about that is...
I'm going to take a quick break, Adam. We can have that story on the other side of the break. We'll be back in just a bit with Adam Rogers.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Adam Rogers, and we're talking about his new book, Proof, The Science of Booze. Now, Adam, right before the break, we were talking about the ways that glasses might affect the ways that we taste drinks.
Yeah, and I was going to tell this story. I'll go fast, but for my birthday last year, I asked for and got two of the glasses that Harrison Ford's character Rick Deckard drinks whiskey from in the movie Blade Runner, his favorite movie of
mine. Yeah, that's quite a gift.
Yeah, and they're beautiful, and you can actually get them. They're expensive crystal. I've wanted them for years, and I finally convinced my mom to get them for me. And so, I drink the same stuff out of those that I was drinking out of the glasses I had before, which were perfectly nice. And does it taste the same? Yeah, of course. But on the other hand, no, absolutely not. You know, it's way more awesome out of the Blade Runner glasses, right?
So there's a scientific term related to how we taste alcohol called conditioned flavor preference. What does that mean?
Well, there's a notion that, in fact, people do not like the taste of ethanol at all, like ethanol on its own. That no mammal really likes it. It's sort of unpleasant. That we, in fact, like the post-ingestive effect, by which I mean you like, sure, the way it makes you feel. And so you kind of retrospectively turn around and decide that you like the taste of it because you like what's going to happen later, and you get conditioned to like it. That's controversial because it's sort of hard to study taste. It's hard to study taste in rats and mice and then make that research apply to people. But the notion is there that, in fact, this, no matter how much of a wine snob or beer connoisseur or whiskey drinker that you are, that actually you're just kidding yourself.
And yeah, you argue that all of these flavors that we throw into, whether it's something we brew into a beer or something we add to a liquor, they're all there really just to mask the actual flavor of ethanol.
That's the notion, yeah. I mean, and so there's some, you know, there's some intuitive power to that, like the idea that the Depression and post-Depression era cocktails kind of grew out of a need to cover up the crummy booze that you could get because it was illegal or illicit, and also the idea that, like, well, what is all that other stuff that's in there? Now, countervailing that notion is if you've ever had alcohol-free beer or wine, it doesn't, in my opinion, it doesn't taste as good. I've had some alcohol-free beer that I thought was actually quite good. And I've had alcohol-free wine that I thought tasted like death. So.
And one of the reasons that it's been tough for scientists to test how alcohol works on subjects, you mentioned rats, but when it comes to people, people pretty much know when they're having a drink that's an actual drink. But at least one test showed that people who weren't actually drinking alcohol started to act as if they were.
Yeah, well, it took decades of research, but finally some researchers figured out how to administer a placebo, basically. Like, they came up with a drink that a person could not tell better than chance whether it had alcohol in it or not. The first version of it was essentially a vodka tonic. And that was really important, because until that point, you couldn't trick somebody into believing that they'd had alcohol or believing that they hadn't had alcohol when they had, maybe even more importantly, right? But once you figured out the drink, then you can do these studies with four different groups. And in fact, they started doing them in rooms that looked a lot like a bar because they wanted to control for conditions as well. You know, there's a big difference between that wonderful bottle of red wine that you had in that small town in Umbria that you found by accident, right? And then you have that same wine sitting at home in front of a Star Trek rerun, and it's not exactly the same experience. So they tried to build, they build these bar labs where they could observe people in bar conditions. And the groups that they would give them were like, okay, you're in a placebo group, so you are not getting alcohol, or you're in a group that is getting alcohol. But you could also have groups where you think you're getting alcohol, but you're not, or you don't think you're getting alcohol, but you are, and use that to try to understand what the actual effects of ethanol on the human body and brain are without somebody expecting them, right? Without us bringing our own preconceptions to it. And yeah, in some cases what they find is that if you think you're getting alcohol, you'll start to slur your words, you'll become more social and voluble, your face will flush, you'll start to manifest a lot of the symptoms of things that you think happen to you when you're drinking, when in fact you haven't had a drop of ethanol.
And it seems like that's maybe part and parcel with that idea about the conditioned flavor preference. Like, we assume that we're going to act a certain way because we want that to be the way that we act, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know if they would go as far as want. That's an interesting question. I mean, what they call it in psychology, it would be an expectancy, right? Mm-hmm. It's the thing that you think is going to happen. And how do those develop? In many cases, it's if you saw the way your parents reacted to alcohol when you were a kid, if your parents drank in front of you, mm-hmm. then you sort of think, oh, well, that's how people do it. Or maybe what you see on a TV show or movies, you know, before you have experience of it yourself, you begin to form your version of the world, I guess, is the idea there. And then that's how you act when you get to the bar when you're old enough. So, this is a hypothesis, right?
Yeah, and so as we talked about, clearly scientists have studied the effects of alcohol on the brain and the body, but one of the real takeaways for me, at least from the book, was that really how little we understand how those things work together. I mean, we have a better understanding of how other drugs like, let's say, marijuana or heroin work on the brain than alcohol.
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting things that I found is that unlike any other recreational drug, human beings use a lot of chemistry for recreation, however you feel about the legality and morality of that. There are a lot of recreational drugs out there, and of all of them, ethanol is the only one for which they haven't articulated a mechanism. They cannot specifically tell you what happens in the brain when we ingest alcohol, and they can pretty much do it for, as you say, things like ethanol or methamphetamine or opium.
Okay, let's talk about the thing that people listening this long to a show about alcohol might be interested in. Why do we get hangovers?
It is such a bummer for me to have to say that nobody really knows why we get hangovers, man. It sucks.
And the idea is that we pretty much know if we get a blood alcohol content at like 0.1 or so that's going to happen, but we don't really know why.
That's right, yeah. And it's super weird. So you get up to 0.1, you know, in like drive DUI is 0.08, right? So you get above, you get 0.1 and up, you're going to be hungover. And things that we know that your hangover symptoms are the worst when your alcohol level is back to zero. Hmm. I say we, like I've done this research. The researchers know about it. Researchers know that while it's true that alcohol does dehydrate you, rehydrating you doesn't make your alcohol symptoms go away. Dehydration is not the hangover, right? All this stuff that they told you the day before your first weekend in college, you know, turned out to be at least not proven and probably not true. It's not sugar levels. It's not congeners. It's not impure alcohol. You don't not get hungover if you only drink vodka, but if you drink bourbon, you do. That's not true. You get just as hungover. It's not sulfites. You know, it's not allergic. It's not, you get more exotic. It's not acetaldehyde toxicity. It's not methanol toxicity. All of these things that, that people will tell you and then give you a sort of, you know, patent medicine level remedy for, just don't seem to be the case. What does seem to be the case is that hangovers look an awful lot like an inflammatory response, like if you have the flu or something and your body's responding overactively to a threat to its immune system. And so anti-inflammatories, there were some tests in Europe on a drug called Clotam, which sadly is not available in the United States, but it's a very high-powered anti-inflammatory, often prescribed for migraine, which is another thing where the symptoms have a lot of overlap with hangover, interestingly. And that seemed to help a lot. And there are some other compounds that you can get over the counter in the U.S. that have been shown in studies, like, yes, these actually do seem to help. Anecdotally, I would say that maybe they don't so much. But at least there's some good science behind things like prickly pear cactus extract or peritanol, which is a vitamin B6 analog, or an extract of a plant from the Chinese pharmacopoeia called oriental raisin or hovenia seems to have some effect as well.
And in terms of preventing hangovers, there's really no science to back up these rules of thumb, like having liquor before beer or anything like that?
Nope. No, it's really depressing. The only way to win is not to play.
Are there any drugs being developed to counteract the things that we don't like about the way alcohol affects us?
Well, this is really interesting. There is a researcher in the UK named David Nutt, N-U-T-T, and he's a very well-respected and well-known researcher on drugs, alcohol included. And he has said, though he has not published as much of this on it as you would like, that he has some chemicals that give you symptoms that are analogous to what you would get from a drink or two. They're benzodiazepine analogs. Benzodiazepines are drugs like Valium, right? And those receptors in the brain seem to be related to ethanol as well. And he says that he has these chemicals. They make you feel like you've had a drink or two and that there's an antidote, that you can take a chemical that counteracts what he has, and you feel fine. You're not drunk anymore. It's like Synthahol from Star Trek.
No.
But he also says he needs more money to do the research, and I didn't actually talk to him. He would not be interviewed. He sent me a couple of his papers, which were not detailed to my eye. But he says he's doing the work. And it's kind of the, to use an overused metaphor, it's a bit of a holy grail, right?
Sure.
You would have a drink that you could take a pill and then go to work. But then again, it wouldn't be a drink, right? Wouldn't have the elegance of sitting in with a nice glass of whiskey from Texas's Balcones Distillery, which makes some of the best craft whiskeys in the country now, and getting the experience of having that stuff and knowing the story behind it. It would just be a pill, which might be a bummer.
And considering how many people suffer from hangovers, I think it's kind of surprising that so little research has actually been done on how to cure them.
And I don't have a good answer for that. The tale that some people will tell you is, well, it's because, you know, the government doesn't want to fund research that would look like it was encouraging the overuse, the misuse of alcohol. And I kind of get that. I don't know if it's true or not. You know, most of the money, this country, the U.S., does spend quite a lot of money on research in alcohol, but a lot of it is in dependency, addiction, binge drinking, behavior of young people around alcohol. And that makes sense because those things can be very dangerous. They cost a lot of money. They can cost people their lives, their livelihoods. You know, you want to spend time making sure that people aren't sick, right? So there's not as much research on the part of it that where I kind of think of my book happening. You know, I think of my book taking place about two sips into the second round.
And
you know, that's sort of the universe. That's the relevant range for me. And there is less research on both the making of, the tasting of, and the experience in the body and brain at those levels.
And I suppose that if you want to take kind of the wide view of things, you could make the argument that hangovers are maybe kind of useful because they serve, a function in terms of how you might approach alcohol in the future.
Well, you know, I mean, far be it from me for making a value judgment on other people's behavior as long as nobody's getting hurt necessarily, right? As long as you're not driving, and as long as your family's not getting screwed up and you're not losing your job. But I will say that as I've gotten older, my hangovers have gotten worse. My tolerance for alcohol has gone down. I now see a hangover as not the paying the piper for an enjoyable weekend, but as a sign that I have really messed up the night before. It is an error in both behavior and judgment on my part.
Okay, so since this is a show about drinks, do you have a go-to drink?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm pretty annoying about drinking now, so it depends on context. But I really do like single malt whiskey quite a lot. And there's a particular distillery called Springbank that I think is great. There's one called Imperial that doesn't exist anymore. So please don't drink Imperial because there's not that much left, and I want it. And then it sort of depends on where I am, man. Sometimes, like, a cold glass of beer is the best possible thing you can be drinking, and sometimes you want an obscure pre-prohibition cocktail. Last night I was drinking something called The Last Word, which is mostly gin, lime, and green chartreuse, and it is a lovely thing to be drinking in a quiet, dark bar.
And was it one of those bartenders that takes these really scientific approaches to making cocktails that made that?
It was not. It was one of those bartenders who takes about the oldest, craftiest, black vest and sleeves rolled up and a little bit of a handlebar mustache.
So along those lines, do you think that higher-end ingredients really make drinks better, or do we think that because we're paying more for those things?
Well, let me answer that two ways. Yes, I do. I mean, I think if you're getting a cocktail especially, but just like with food, you know, in a restaurant, like, fresh tomatoes are better than canned tomatoes, you know? And similarly, like, freshly squeezed lemon juice is better than lemon juice from a bottle. House-made tonic water is better than tonic water from a gun. Like, yeah, these things taste better because there's more care behind them and because they're fresher, and so they don't taste canned or old. I think that makes a lot of difference. But I would also say that it's very easy to get caught up in the craft distilling movement as this is a representation of quality, because we remember that from craft brewing 30 years ago, right, where, like, if you decided that, you know, Budweiser and Coors did not represent the end-all and be-all of beer flavor, and in fact, you could go to some local brewery, Cellus, right, the big Texas one, and get something really great, right, that tasted different and better. But I think with craft distilling, it's a little bit different because, you know, they make an ocean of Jack Daniels every year. Jack Daniels is great whiskey, genuinely great, right? Wild Turkey, same thing. So these are the big transnational drinks brands, but they're able to make a product that's really delicious already. So, you know, do you want to be spending a gazillion dollars on a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle 22-year-old bourbon that has kind of an artificial shortage in fat around it? Well, maybe if that's fun and that's your thing, and if you're really going to enjoy that process and have that kind of scratch to throw around, sure. But I'm telling you, you can get a bottle of Bullet, which is a cheap industrial bourbon, it is delicious, and especially for, you know, $20 a bottle. We go through a lot of Bullet at Wired Magazine.
Our guest today, Adam Rogers, is the author of Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, it's been a fascinating hour. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Think is produced by yours truly and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Stephen Becker. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.